Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, drinking, and awesomeness. It's time for our top data-related articles and blog posts from the past week. If at any time we say anything that doesn't make sense, just blame it on the fact that we are drinking. Links to all stories we discussed today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter, at @partiallyd. My name is Chris Albin, and with me today is my co-host, Jonathan Morgan, and also with me is our repeat guest co-host, I think would be the way to put it, Ashley McNamara. Say hi, Ashley.
Hello.
We are available everywhere on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Second, if you are listening on iTunes, please review us. Unless you hate something we say, all good reviews are welcome. If you hate us, go do something else. Maybe post on Twitter or something. Maybe go to Reddit.
No. Send Chris an email, a personal email.
That's
where all the bad comments go, because they're all about Chris anyway.
All right. So next big thing, third, and most importantly, beers. Ashley, what are you drinking?
I am drinking Austin Beer Works Black Thunder, which coincidentally is also my nickname.
Wow.
All right, cool. That will generate some exciting conversation on Twitter. I am also drinking Austin Beer Works. I am drinking Peacemaker, which is not my nickname. Because everybody knows when Jonathan's in the house, he's bringing the haterade. So, by the way, we have like, I'll post this on Twitter. We have like a whole, I don't know, like a case worth of beer. Ashley walked in with like two armfuls of beer into this room that we're sitting in. And so perhaps by the end of this week's episode, things are going to get a little wild. There's a lot of Black Thunder in here.
There's a lot of Black Thunder. But to be fair, today is my birthday, so I'm drinking.
Oh.
Happy 25th birthday.
Thank you.
Chris, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking El Tesoro tequila with lime and a little bit of agave, which I now realize is basically like the poor man's sort of margarita because I don't have triple sec or anything in there. So I just have like agave two ways, one for the tequila and one for the agave syrup, and then just a bunch of limes in there. And it's actually freaking good.
All right, cool. I think this is the episode when people officially say that we went off the rails.
Next week, it's just like rubbing alcohol.
I ran out of limes. All I have is rubbing alcohol. Mouthwash. My nickname is Mouthwash.
All right, so should we talk about some stuff? Actually, you know what? Before we do any of the stories this week, as usual, we have an interview. Let's go to the interview. All right, gang, so I am here with Ben Wellington, who is the data scientist behind the wildly popular iQuantNY blog, which uses open data to investigate all sorts of interesting things about the city of New York. He is a fantastic advocate for open data. His TED Talk, his New York TED Talk, is super interesting. You should go look it up on the internet if you haven't seen it already, and you should definitely follow iQuantNY. And now, Ben, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, fantastic. So is there anything else that our listeners should know about you and the work that you're doing?
definitely centers around the blog. The blog comes from some of my work teaching statistics at Pratt, which is a urban planning and architecture, well, partially urban planning and architecture school in Brooklyn.
Oh, cool.
So that's kind of part of what I'm up to as well.
Okay, fantastic. And you kind of cover just about everything to do with open data in New York, although I've seen a lot about transportation. It seems like, yeah. Is that how you kind of got into it or sort of started chipping away at some of the problems you were finding?
You know, there's two reasons I look at a lot of transportation. One is that there's just a lot of data on it. You have schedules, you have people entering and exit subways, you have people getting parking tickets, and really across the board. And some of it's kind of mundane, right? I like to look at things that people don't think are the sexy new data set. Like,
sure.
Like parking tickets, who sits around thinking parking tickets are cool? I think maybe just me.
Right. But kind of novel stuff comes out, right? Like actually interesting, yeah, insights into how New Yorkers behave or how the city functions, like all sorts of really actionable stuff, right? Even though it seems like at first parking tickets might be a little trap.
Right. Yeah, that's the idea, you know, and I like using parking tickets as an example because you can probably, I could probably think of 100 different sort of interesting things to study with them. You know, where are the most gold cars in New York? Are they in the poorest neighborhoods or the richest neighborhoods, right?
Right.
Where can you track the way the police walk around and give tickets every day so that you can kind of figure out when they're going to be on your block. Can you find the most ticketed person in all of New York and figure out what their story is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the list goes on and on. And actually, I guess the most interesting one that I mentioned in the TED Talk that you discussed was finding the fire hydrants that were generating the most parking tickets in New York. these fire hydrants made more than minimum wage. It was a good gig. They just hung out as fire hydrants. And they were bringing in there's two of them next to each other. They're bringing in $55,000 a year.
Wow.
North of for like 5 or 10 years. And it was just a disagreement between the city of New York's Department of Transportation, who painted a parking spot, and the police department, who ticketed the parking spot. There was basically a bike lane, what looked to be a bike lane between the spot and the hydrant. And so you weren't really at the hydrant. You felt like you were far enough away. But this is exactly what open data allows us to do, right? It allows you at a very local level to think about the questions that maybe, you know, your government officials don't have time to always dive into. And we can start to ask ourselves meaningful information at a very, very local level, so that instead of being the annoying person who just complains at a meeting, you're the annoying person with data at a meeting who complains. And that buys you a little more credibility, I think. And that's why, you know, in this case, the story was picked up. It was in the London Daily Mail, these hydrants. And sure enough, the city actually repainted the spots within a few weeks. So it shows what kind of, you know, small change in this case open data can bring. There's been a few other fun ones. When I was digging around in New York City taxi data, I actually figured out that we have two different computer systems in the back of our cabs. One run by a company called Creative Mobile Technologies, and one by a company called, I don't know, I'm forgetting the name. I can't remember the other one, but that's not important part of the story.
All right.
It turned out that when you ride a cab in New York, you're offered a screen when you get out, and it says, "Do you want to tip 20? 25 or 30%, which are nice options.
That's a lot of tip.
And when you hit that 20% button, I don't think most people stop and think, you know, what am I paying 20% of, right?
Right.
Well, it turned out that it depended on which computer ran the system in your back. So half of our cabs in New York, you hit the 20% button, you were tipping on your base fare. But the other half, you were tipping on your base fare and tolls and taxes.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Now, that doesn't sound like a big deal, but I did the math, and the cab drivers driving one half of the fleet were making $300 to $400 a year more in tips.
Right. That really adds up. I mean, every little cab, right? Every little tax, every little, it's not insignificant.
And so when I wrote about that, the TLC put out a great statement, which said something like, "We are aware of what he wrote, and we're giving it a thorough read." which I appreciated. Amazing. I get a lot of gem statements from city agencies, but... and actually, within about a week, they actually had reprogrammed the cabs. Not as I had anticipated. It turned out they took the ones that used to be rounding not on everything and updated them to also make them higher. So I think I may have made half the cabs in New York slightly more expensive. But at least it's, you know, equality, and we don't have to worry about the computer program in the back of our cabs. Once again, this is the kind of thing that I don't necessarily expect agencies to always notice. But when the data's out there and you have so many eyes, you can kind of outsource this idea generation to the community. You know, that's what's so cool about this type of data set is that your people aren't necessarily looking at it. So it really feels like, you know, right ground. And I find that if you take a column, like, people are intimidated by the number of columns in a data set. But if you take a single column and you look for like maxes or mins or outliers, you know, every outlier has a story to tell, right? And so, you know, take a data set like that and go find, I looked at the people complaining about the driveways being blocked. And so I found the driveway that was most blocked in New York. And it was a poor guy whose driveway kind of sunk into the ground, like underground, and so no one could see that it was a driveway.
Oh, man.
But, you know, the most or the least of anything can have an interesting story behind it. So I always find that kind of inspires me when I look at the data set, that there's just so many stories in every one.
Well, cool. I mean, well, it sounds like it's going really well. And it sounds like it's a lot of fun, frankly.
And the cool part is that I was able to it's about official, but I got a book deal.
No way.
And I'm going to be sort of studying details should be announced hopefully really, really soon. But I'm going to be studying kind of what you said, you know, the way each of these leads to a human, which I like that you said that.
Yeah.
It's that idea. How can we study human behavior in new ways kind of globally by taking these kind of mundane random data sets in cities across the world and finding what
what stories they can tell us. So I'm super excited about that, but except for the part where you have to write the whole thing. And that's about a year and a half of work. So check back in 2 years and we can talk and see how it went. But I am excited. I'm excited. There's so many stories to tell in New York. There must be stories all around the world. So I'm super excited to go and find those stories.
Have you started this project at all? Can you give us any surprises that you've already discovered?
I'll give you one example, okay. Which I kind of like to do, which is exploring safety in cities by the time of day that people are willing to ride bike shares.
Okay.
So you take, and in fact, if you look at the female to male ratio and you break it down by city or by neighborhood even, you can start to get an interesting view on our perceptions of safety. So you can kind of start to see, well, in this city, the percent female rider drops to 5% quite early, at midnight, whereas mm-hmm. in other cities, maybe it goes on till 3 or 4 in the morning. And you can do that on a neighborhood level, on a city level, and start to draw just interesting comparisons. So those are the kind of, outside the box thing I'm looking forward to doing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, that's cool. I'm sure people around the world will be really excited to understand where they live and how other people live in a totally new way. How can people find you on the internet to make sure that they're up to date with all the cool stuff you're doing?
Yeah. So actually, because I'm lazy, my site lives on Tumblr.
All right.
So it's iQuantNY, as in like quantify. And so you can find me on there. Or I've got a mailing list on there, which maybe you get one email, two a month. So not too bad. And then okay. And then Twitter, iQuantNY on Twitter. So I'd love for people to come find me there and very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I love the show.
All right, awesome. Okay, so now let's move onward to talking about some of the week's stories. The first one is about something that I'm sure is dear to all of our hearts, shark attacks.
Don't go into the shark's home, people. Don't go into the shark's home.
So the first thing in my notes that I don't quite have, I'm not going to say, is I put the theme song to Jaws. You know, like when Jaws comes in and he's like approaching the boat and he's like, na, 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 na. I was just going to launch into that. But now it seems like it'd be crazy. But the point is that this is about sharks like Jaws. And if one thing we can all agree on, it's that summer brings us this glorious, terrifying, and really creepy looking world of underwater sea monsters. It's Shark Week on TV, and people all over the place are getting attacked by really big, scary, toothy fish. Are sharks fish?
Sure.
Okay.
They're fish. They're not mammals. Like,
they're not mammals. Maybe they're like dinosaurs.
I only know two types of animals. They're either like fish, and I eat them, like Baja style, or they're mammals.
All right,
and
cool.
I grill them first.
All right, so shark tacos are the scariest thing on television and in the ocean. But the thing that's really scary about shark attacks is it's like we all go to the beach and most of us think of swimming as this laid back kind of thoughtless activity while we kill time between barbecues and day drinking like today. But beware, lurking on the ocean floor just out of sight are creatures that will totally eat you. So how do you know if you're at risk? Data to the rescue. In a new series called Data Points, National Geographic is using a global shark attack database. This is a real thing that apparently we've been visualizing all morning, says Chris, off in chat. We totally have. So look out for fun from that later if you'd like to see the spike of global shark attacks in the past 100 years. But in any case, National Geographic has also been breaking down shark attacks in the hopes that they can get a better idea about where the next shark will strike its victim. So you might think that based on recent news that we are seeing a huge increase in the number of shark attacks this summer, because if you, like me, are often in airports that play CNN news, I swear it's as if Jaws is happening, like, on the news, on TV. Like, wherever you turn, small children are being swept into the ocean and, like, whatever, right? But fortunately, the sharks have not gone crazy, and they're not on some horrible, bloody mission to take over the planet by slowly eating the humans. In fact, though the number of shark attacks off the coast of North Carolina is a little higher than normal, overall, this shark season is pretty much on trend. That doesn't mean that you can't take some common sense precautions when avoiding these fearsome predators. For example, shark attacks are more likely to happen on the east coast of the United States than the west coast, according to Nat Geo. High five, California! Woo! All right. The states with the most shark attacks are Florida and Hawaii. Turns out this is because the type of sharks that live in these areas are more comfortable swimming closer to shore, where they are more likely to bump into food. People. Okay, so what's also kind of cool is that the data points team pulls together other data, like not just the global database, but they've actually pulled in other factors to guess about what, like the reasons behind these shark attacks, because they've been increasing in general. And it looks like there are two factors causing the uptick in attacks over the years. One is that more people are going swimming in the summer, so obviously, more people in the water, more sharks eating the people. The other thing that's causing these increase in shark attacks is that there's changes in the ocean's climate, so they're driving sharks into areas where they weren't as prevalent as before. So more sharks and more people equals more scary CNN stories. So even though all the hysteria over the recent events in North Carolina is a little bit blown out of proportion, at least according to the numbers, it may be that as a species, we humans need to figure out how to handle ourselves against the ancient monsters of the deep.
That is pretty actually interesting. So
almost interesting.
Like, okay. And I can tell you some cool things that are happening, right? So it is of shark attacks, it's like 1778 that have been reported. It's 89% male, so it sucks to be a man in that particular situation.
Wait a second. Why do all the sharks attack? I'm totally serious. Can we speculate for a second? Why do sharks only attack men?
I have some ideas. Maybe not safe for air, but I have ideas.
Lay it out there. We can edit it out later if it's more offensive than we normally are.
I'm just saying, you guys are idiots, and I would eat you if I were in the ocean. Just me like, yeah. That's a penis. He's going. He's dead.
I am sick of seeing penises.
I'm sick of them. Do you think it's do you think that, you know, like on the East Coast, people are weightier than on the West Coast? They have, you know, like biscuits and gravy, and they're just tastier folk, I think. I think that's what it is.
I think that's also possible. I thought you were also heading in like a perhaps more slow moving direction. Like
also slow, yes.
Also slow moving. I mean, because if they're not as svelte as our West Coast brethren, it might be that they just don't have the speed and agility to get out of the water.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, in Florida, old people.
Old people. Well, it's their time.
Florida is by far the most popular place for shark attacks. There's 934 shark attacks in Florida, and then the next highest one is 446 in New South Wales. Basically, shark attacks are happening to Floridians.
When I'm old and retired and living in Florida like they all do, I hope that that's in my obituary. I hope that that's how I go out, is shark attack.
Although it sounds like your likelihood of getting attacked by a shark without a penis
is really small.
It's really small. You have to work for it.
I'm going to have to work for it. It's unfortunate.
All right. So, the big news this week, if you're pretty geeky like me, is that Greece is in trouble. Huge, huge trouble. So the short version of this is that the Greece crisis, or the Greece debt crisis as it's called, actually started when Greece joined what's called the Eurozone, which is sort of the economic component of the EU. Like, that means they have the euro and that kind of stuff. But it also means that creditors started loaning Greece money at the same rates that they would loan, say, really big, strong European economies like Germany. And oh boy, did Greece start borrowing. Like, they borrowed like crazy, which turns out is problematic because Greece has a problem with collecting taxes. So this whole thing came to a head a few years ago when the Greek government admitted that for years, maybe decades, they have been grossly underreporting their budgetary deficit, which is sort of diplomatic speak to saying they were paying for everything, all the sort of pensions and all the salaries out of borrowed money, and then they were lying to creditors about their ability to pay back that money.
Wait, why did people believe that for so long? This is the thing that I didn't understand about the Greek debt crisis. It's like they were saying, oh yeah, it's totally plausible that we don't have any money and we don't collect any taxes, and everybody kind of knows that we don't collect any taxes, and we are totally cool. Everything is cool. It's like, I mean, was it like the Socratic method? Like somebody was like, hey, Greece, do you have money to pay your debts? And they were like, what do you think a debt is?
I will say, to give a shout out to another great podcast, Planet Money, which I'm sure some of you have heard of, actually did an episode about the European Union representative who went to the Greek like financial ministry and was in charge of sort of finding out what was happening with the debt. And his story is like crazy. Just this lone dude surrounded by all these people who've been lying left, right, and center about what was like, how much they owed and their ability to pay and all this kind of stuff. And this like one guy is faced with all of it. It is a crazy story. We'll actually link to it on partiallyderivative.com. But to go back to this story, so when people found out that they were lying about their ability to borrow money, like the Greek economy went crazy. Like literally over the last 5 years, it shrunk 25%, which might not seem like that much, but in economic terms, that's insane. Like that's like Great Depression insane.
That sounds
now,
bad.
It's really pretty bad. I think it's actually right like next to the Great Depression. So now the Greek I can hear the beer. Now the Greek economy is, you know, in this like weird three-way battle between creditors who want to bail them out, but only if they have strict spending restrictions, right? This is called austerity. Yeah. And their citizens who are just gawking at the idea of these like really incredible proposed cuts, like cutting pensions this huge degree and firing all much people from the government and that kind of stuff. Okay, so what does data science have to do with it? And Timo Elliott in Forbes has a great article about something called Benford's Law, and how it could be used to detect Greece's misreporting, we'll call it. So, I will now explain to you Benford's Law.
Misrepresentation.
Misrepresentation, the like fudging of the numbers. Okay, this is going to take a second to explain. All right. So this is going to take a second to explain. So let me take a few steps back. It turns out that many things in nature, like the flow of a river or the airspeed of a hurricane or a bunch of stuff in mathematics, follow what are either exponential or logarithmic functions.
And are you going to explain what that is? Because I think, you know, we're all pretty geeky on this podcast, but I barely remember logarithmic functions and I use them all the time.
I will go into exactly what it is. So,
thank you.
An exponential function is a function that grows slow at first and then grows faster and faster. So an example of this would be like a viral video of a puppy or something like that, right? Like first when it's posted, nobody really watches it, blah, blah, blah. But then people start to share it. And the number of viewers grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. And until it's like being viewed, you know, millions of times a second. And this is actually what people often call in business a hockey stick, because it looks like the shape of a hockey stick if you sort of lay it on the ground, right? It's like slow at first and then it zips up really fast. A logarithmic function is basically functionally the opposite. It grows super fast at the start and then its growth slows over time. So this would be like the growth rate of a baby, right? Babies grow insane at first. And if they continue to grow at that rate, like someone calculated, they'd be like 1 trillion pounds or something like that by then. Like they grow so fast at first, but then they're growing slow as they become, you know, like toddlers and kids, the teenagers. And it basically stops when they're like around 20, right? That would be a logarithmic growth function.
I had no idea that baby growth was logarithmic. I'm not even joking. I've had a baby. I helped raise a baby. I didn't come out of me. But...
All right. So a side effect of this is where it gets a little bit weird, is the fact that since many things are logarithmic or exponential in nature, I'll skip the reason why, but you just have to trust me that it means that the first digit tends to be ones or low numbers more than high numbers. In fact, if we actually took a huge list of numbers found in nature, like river flows or something like that, 30.1% of the first number would be 1, and then 17.6% would be 2, and 12.5 would be 3, right? So the first number in those digits would be 1. It's totally strange, but it actually makes complete mathematical sense, and there's tons of tutorials, which I will link to on partiallyderivative.com as to why.
What kind of number, though? What's the sort of number that you're talking about here? So, like, the number that represents the flow of a river at any given point, or, like, the... In this case, it'd be like the amount of like Greek debt or something. Like what does that number represent?
So it turns out it's almost not everything, but a huge number of things. So let's say the amount of gallons of water that flowed past a point in a river on a certain day, or the speed of, let's say the speed of a hurricane, you know, as you fly into the, as you go farther and farther into the hurricane, or things like actually like voting returns tend to follow this pattern as well. There's just a huge number of things in nature that because they follow exponential and logarithmic functions, they tend to have lots and lots of ones as the first digit in numbers, whatever those numbers are, less twos, less threes, less fours, et cetera, all the way down to 9. Okay, what does this have to do with Greece? Well, it turns out that if I told you to write 100 numbers at random, you would probably try to simulate randomness by, you know, just roughly having equal numbers of ones and twos and threes and fours, right? So first you would have like 34, and then you'd have 65, and then you'd have 23, and you'd try to like work it your way through that. So each number seemed different than all the other numbers in around it.
Yeah, you'd like space it out, right?
Exactly. And this turns out to be true for exactly what people do when they lie with numbers. They tend to not follow Benford's law when they're writing down these numbers because they're simulating randomness. They're not actually, because they're simulating randomness in things that aren't random. Okay. And since we know now that Greece submitted fake economic data for years, that data actually would not have followed Benford's law because they were making up the numbers, which is exactly what was found in a 2010 paper, which found, quote, data reported by Greece shows the greatest deviation from Benford's law amongst all European states. So, like, this is a huge point, is that we can actually tell things with Benford's law. We can catch people lying with Benford's law. And it's actually used in a lot of things, such as catching voter fraud and that kind of stuff in a lot of countries, like electoral fraud, because people write fake numbers and they don't follow Benford's law. And then we know it should, and we can compare that to what it those the type of digits that should be there. Okay, so why did data science have a chance to save in Greece and didn't? To recap, Greece
because nobody understands Benford's law.
Okay, wait, I got this. I got a total recap.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Greece borrowed a ton of money and submitted fake data to prove that they could pay it back. That fake data would not have followed the first digit pattern we frequently see in nature, as in Benford's law. Thus, it would have been detectable if we had the time to apply statistics and data science to the problem. Boom. This podcast is now coming to an end.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
This absolutely best and most informative sort of 30-ish minutes of your life has come to a close. I am sorry for all the parts where any of us talked. Credit for the music you're hearing right now goes to Professor Click. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at PartiallyD and visit us at partiallyderivative.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Chris Alvin. You can follow my co-host on Twitter at Jonathan Morgan. And you can follow Ashley on Twitter at Ashley McNamara.
Yes.
Nice.
Nailed it.
Have a great week, all.
Goodbye.
Bye.
It's like Chuck going into a Catholic church and trying to buy a bottle of wine.
I think we have our shit together. We're good.
Can I pause for a second? Can I pause? So if we make jokes about, like, Greek people in general...
You can see some parts of this episode are going to be cut out.